We know the war as a way to handle any kind of conflict must become outmoded, just like slavery became outmoded in most parts of the world. So I realize that as a conscientious objector, it's key to the evolution and survival of our species. That's a big answer. But the most important thing that we can do is for soldiers who are feeling that little thing in their heart is to surround them and protect them for the long haul, to say, you can do what you know is right, and we will make sure that you have a transition or a bridge into wholeness so you can be the wonderful person doing the things you're supposed to do in the world, and that this kind of experience that you had here, deep in the deepest parts of your soul, is the same experience you can see for not only other Americans who are in the military, but other people across the world. And it's that building of that and supporting that very, very human effort to get in touch with that I think is the greatest hope for future peace.
Yeah, I really want to springboard off what Amy just said. I want to talk kind of more specifically about what makes soldiers come to that realization, or what makes the table leg fall out, in my case, but I think it's very general, and I've met a lot of people who oppose the war. For me, what it is it's stepping up to the mirror and seeing yourself staring back at you. All of the rhetoric and the politics and the intellectual stuff about imperialism and capitalism and the machine, I don't think that really talks to soldiers very well. Like, that's not their experience. The way people change is, for me, it's standing across barbed wire, razor wire, and looking at a man who's my own age, who's a soldier, who doesn't want to be a soldier any more than I want to be a soldier. That's what changed it for me. For Kevin Benderman, who's a father, it was seeing young children drinking out of a mud puddle in Iraq. For women in my unit, it was seeing an Iraqi woman being mishandled at Abu Ghraib. So what it is for each person is whoever they are, they come to this point where they look across and they see themselves in the other person. Maybe it was easier for me because I'd grown up in the Middle East, I spoke Arabic, I could talk to people, and I got a sense of them as human beings. But for other people in my unit, Arabic was just gibberish, just noise. And so they had no sense of that other person as a human being. But there would be that one moment, you know, where they have a young daughter and they see an Iraqi little girl in distress. And that's when they look across the mirror and they're like, oh my God, this is me. So I think a lot of the intellectual rhetoric about, like, stamp out the war machine, destroy the military-industrial complex, is not talking to people's real experience. What talks to people's real experience is, like, do you realize that the person you're killing has a child just like you? Do you realize that you might be a woman soldier and you're subjecting an Iraqi woman to abuse in Abu Ghraib prison? Do you realize that there's an 11-year-old in custody at Abu Ghraib, along with all these other people? And when they make that connection, then everything changes for them, and they can't fight anymore, just like Kevin Benderman. And I think the way to do that is to educate people about Iraq on, like, a human level, but to talk to people's similarities, like, between Iraqis and Americans on a personal level. And that really speaks to soldiers' experiences. Because when soldiers come back from the war and they talk about why I hate Iraq or why I'm against the war now, nobody ever says, oh, I realized there was this military-industrial complex and it was driving oil politics and security. No, nobody ever says that. They said, I saw a kid who was burned. Or, you know, in my case, they're like, well, we killed these prisoners for protesting. So that's the experience that's meaningful to them. And that's what we in the peace movement need to focus on, is those personal experiences rather than rhetoric.
As we're talking, folks, about ways to, as Amy said, connect and support for the long term people who are resisting, and also just hearing about the importance for folks who are in the military who are thinking about that, of seeing that it's possible and seeing those examples of people standing up and resisting, and how powerful it is to think about how much support could be visible to those folks who are thinking about resisting. If they know that that support is going to be there, not just for the moment when they're actually standing up and doing it and starting that process or going to trial, but for the long term, and knowing that they really are embraced and being held as part of a movement. Think about how powerful that is, and think about what each one of us here in the room can be doing to contribute to that. And if what we're trying to do is we're really trying to build a global movement for peace and justice, and that as one war resister was saying about another one last year during his trial, that resistors are not just undermining the ability of the war machine, as Amy was saying, but that they're actually putting the only superpower in the world on trial when they're going through this process and going through these public trials. So what can we be doing to support that? I mean, that's huge. We're fighting something overwhelming, but soldiers who are resisting are in such a critical role around this. And so I wanna make a couple rounds of appreciation, and I wanna actually like do it quietly and encourage people to really feel where this hits you in your body, to think about this, to appreciate not just the courage of people like Amy and Aiden, who are working so tirelessly for this, who are going through, you know, have been through this process themselves, are continuing to go through it, and who are supporting so many other people to do that, and how important that is. And then also to thank the people who are doing it really quietly, like Amy was saying earlier, the people who are resisting, who aren't public, who are doing this work unseen, who may not be speaking out right now, but who are really such a part of the back that the anti-war movement is resting on, and how critical they are. And then the third is that there are so many quiet healers among us, who are the people who are supporting vets when they come back, who are family members and friends and community members. And I want to ask my mom to stand up. And I want to appreciate people like my mom. My dad's a Vietnam vet who's a peace worker. And I don't know if it would be possible for him to be doing as much as he is without people like my mom. And so I want to give honor to these people who are doing this work all the time so quietly and who are the movement that we're building. And I'm so happy to have you all here today, because this is where we need to be going. And this is powerful, and this is how we're going to win. So I think you should have the last
All right.
This has been a recording of Amy Allison and Aiden Delgado on Throwing Down Against Empire, Military Veterans Speak Out on Practical Strategies to End War. They spoke at the National Conference on Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on February 5, 2006. The other speakers were James from the War Resisters League and Clay Bayard from the Catalyst Project. Thanks for listening.
And thanks to George King for that recording. There are believed to be more than 1,000 U.S. soldiers who have fled to Canada to escape the military, and a few of them are battling the Canadian courts now to receive asylum. On June 16th and 17th, there will be an historic gathering at the U.S.-Canadian border in Buffalo, New York, and Fort Erie, Ontario. The event is called Peace Has No Borders, and its purpose is to support U.S. war resistors who are seeking asylum from the government of Canada. For more information on how to attend the event, visit Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQC Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.
I had a first cousin called Arthur McBride. He and I took a stroll down by the seaside, seeking good fortune and what might betide. 'Twas just as the day was at dawning. After resting, we both took a tramp. We met Sergeant Harper and Corporal Cramp, besides the wee drummer who beat up for camp with his rowdy dow dow in the morning. He says, my young fellows, if you will enlist, a guinea you quickly will have in your fist, besides a crown for to kick up the dust and drink the king's health in the morning. For a soldier, he leads a very fine life. He always is blessed with a charming young wife, and he pays all his debts without sorrow or strife, and always lives happy and charming. And a soldier he always is decent and clean, while other poor fellows go dirty and mean. While other poor fellows go dirty and mean, and sup on thin gruel in the morning. Says Arthur, I wouldn't be proud of your clothes, for you've only the lend of them, as I suppose, and you dare not change them one night, for you know if you do you'll be flogged in the morning. And although we are single and free, we take great delight in our own company, and we have no desire strange countries to see, although that your offer is charming. And we have no desire to take your advance, all hazards and dangers we barter on chance, and you'd have no scruple to send us to France, where we would be shot without warning. And now, says the sergeant, if I hear but one word, I instantly now will out with my sword, and into your bodies as strength will afford. So now, my gay devils, take warning. But Arthur and I, we took the odds. We gave them no chance for to launch out their swords. Whacking shillelaghs came over their heads and paid them right smart in the morning. As for the wee drummer, we rifled his pow, and we made a football of his rowdy dow-dow. Into the ocean to rock and to row, and bad at a tedious returning. As for the old rapier that hung by his side, we flung it as far as we could in the tide. To the devil I pitch you, says Arthur McBride, to temper your steel in the morning.
Traditional Irish song sung by Andy Irvine. Predatory military recruiters are nothing new, but the U.S. government has created intrusive policies to gain unprecedented access to young Americans for recruiting purposes through the No Child Left Behind Act, which purports to be about improving education. In the recent revelations about government spying on Americans, many, including members of Congress, expressed amazement that Quaker pacifist meetings had been listed as a credible threat to national security. You're about to find out why this historic pacifist church is posing a credible threat. The Friends, the proper term for the Quakers, have a long history of activism against war and are currently playing a central role on the ground to foil military recruitment efforts in schools. Conscious Alternatives to Militarism is one such group now active in schools in the Finger Lakes region. Recently, they held a workshop for people wanting to get involved in anti-war work of this kind. We'll conclude the program with highlights of that three-hour workshop.
My name is Marilyn Gray. I'm a member of Ithaca Friends Meeting. I actually came to this work back in the Vietnam War when I did conscientious objection to war counseling. I lived up 250 miles north of here and was on the edge of the Underground Railroad that was taking people into Canada at that time. Since then, I have moved away from it and come back to it, depending on what our government is doing at any given time, and have been very, very active since we started talking about going into Iraq, and helped organize the group that is sponsoring this gathering today, Conscious Alternatives to Militarism. Let me move this to Brian.
My name is Brian Williams, and I live here in Scava County in the town of Hector, I'm a member of the Perry City Friends meeting and Watkins Glen School District, and a group of us has actually been working with Watkins Glen. I have tabled a few times, and you'll hear more about that as we go forward. I've also started working with Odessa Montour. I own some property in that area. And I came to this largely after the war started in Iraq and becoming concerned about the increased recruitment of our youth, and I'm especially sensitive to it. I do work for an economic development agency. I'm kind of aware of some of the limited opportunities for young people in our area specifically, and wanted to get involved to see how I can improve their situation.
My name is Donna Beckwith, and I was an Army brat until I was 13 years old, so I have a real different insider view of what it's like to live in the military. I came to this work because I have three sons who are now young adults, but as they got into their teens, I became aware of what my father and my brothers went through and really wanted to do something different. And around that time, I met a man named Bill Galvin, who works in Washington with the Center for Conscience in War, and that got me started. And now I'm in the Watkins Glen School District. I'm Brian's neighbor. I go into the school with him. And we're just going wherever this leads us.
Here are a few of the voices of people who attended.
I, lived through the Vietnam War, and I was drafted and refused to go and ended up spending 2 years kind of living underground, as we called it, like not using your Social Security number and stuff like that. And then another 2 years of probation after that. And then so I was aware of kind of the history of the United States global militarism and how it affects the lives not only of the people that are being killed overseas, but the lives of young people being disrupted, and the fact that the working class and lower class, underclass people are the ones who feed the, are the kind of cannon fodder for the goals of the corporate agenda.
Last year, the ladies put together a club, Democratic Women's Club, and that was the first time that I heard this idea of the military going into our schools and trying to get kids to sign up. And then my daughter came home one afternoon last year with this keychain thing around her neck, Army of One, and a couple of other little things, with Army logos. And my daughter wants to be a chef. The gentleman told her that, you could have the best training in the world with the Army, and you'd be a wonderful chef, and blah, blah, blah. And she came home all excited, and this is after years of listening to her overbearing mother saying that she hated the war and she hated the Army and blah, blah, blah. So they're very persuasive. These guys, very persuasive. So I feel strongly that there needs to be some balance in our schools. If they're going to hear that, then they need to hear the other side, and that it's not the Army and the military is not just a way to because you may be a little slow or you may come from a bad home or that this is your only option. It's not your only option. There's plenty of options, and kids need to hear that.
I'm in the Spencer Vinetton School District, which is about 25 miles from Ithaca, south of Ithaca. I have a granddaughter who's in the high school. Of course, the war is, unconscionable. And the fact that so many of the fellows are coming home wounded, both physically and mentally, I just feel that the kids have to understand that this is a life-changing situation. And mental health is really important because that's something that doesn't bounce right back once you get over there and come home.
I'm a pastor of the Baptist Church in Painted Post. It's American Baptist Church. Was in college at Penn State University in the 60s, 1966 is when I entered. On the first retreat, they're always trying to get a hold of freshmen. The churches had a flyer in my mailbox, and I met this man who had been was a campus minister. And he had been a conscientious objector during World War II. And, I thought this man was totally out to lunch. My father was a career military man. 30 years in the military, landed at D-Day, Omaha Beach, the whole routine. And the short story is that over a course of 3 years, I became a conscientious objector. And it put me in a different perspective, a different position with my family and with a lot of people within my denomination. And I really gave up in the church for a while, and I taught elementary school thinking that was the best way to make positive changes. But came back to the ministry, worked in a church in Christian education for about 16 years, and then have taken this church in Painted Post. And I work with a lot of young people. I see a lot of young people. My two daughters now are graduated from high school and out of college. They talk to me about their friends who, again, has been already been mentioned, they go off into the military with such grand ideals, only to be very disappointed, in some ways damaged for the rest of their lives. It's just such a sad use of human spirit and energy.
I'm here for a couple of reasons. I'm here to learn more, to help do work, because I think it's very important. I don't want recruiters after my son. I have already experienced recruiters after my daughter, who is now 21, and I didn't like them calling the house. And when I told them not to call, they said that this was the government and they were allowed to call wherever they wanted to. I said, this is a private number and you're forbidden to call here. I'm telling you, you're harassing me. And they kept calling, and I said, one more, and I'm going to report you. Don't you ever call my house again. You keep the hell away from my daughter. I'm also a massage therapist, and we're starting to talk in our profession about people seeing folks coming back from Iraq, coming back from Afghanistan. I haven't personally seen that, although I've seen the spouses of those folks. And as you said, they're extremely damaged people. I mean, they're still Vietnam veterans. You can almost recognize them, not always, but somebody who's really been fried, you can still see a lot of that. And I don't want that to be a whole nother generation.
I go to the Trumansburg High School. I'm pretty new to this scene, but currently I'm helping Margot table at Trumansburg and pass out anti-recruiting information there. I'm currently going through establishing a file as a conscientious objector.
I was given my draft notice 2 weeks before I graduated from Syracuse as a pre-med student, and sought to have an exemption, which was denied. And so my family, who was pretty leftist in their politics, we sat down and discussed, you know, whether I was going to flee to Canada, whether I was going to go ahead and enlist. And I did end up enlisting, became a Rescue Navy helicopter pilot, served for 5 years, never fired a shot in anger, and rescued several people. I'm still wrestling with some of my experiences, in that several of my friends didn't come back from Vietnam. I was stationed on the East Coast, was scheduled to go to Vietnam in 1970, and my cruise was canceled. But even the ones that didn't go, there are scars that remain.
Back to presenter Brian Williams.
I'm just going to speak for a bit on the No Child Left Behind Act and how that fits into military recruiting in the schools and any counter-recruitment, or what we now might call recruitment awareness efforts. Buried in the act are some requirements regarding military recruiters' access to schools. Essentially, under access to students, the military recruiters are to be given the same access to students as is generally provided to post-secondary educational institutions, colleges, for example, or prospective employers. And also, school districts are required to release what they call directory information about students, which is names, addresses, and telephone listings to recruiters, if asked. One reason why this is top on our list of things to discuss is because parents and students do have the right under the No Child Left Behind Act to opt out of having their contact information released to recruiters. Now, that doesn't mean that recruiters can't get students' information any other way. They can go through phone books. They can ask someone who has actually signed up if they can provide names and contact information of their friends. But at least this is, not only is this one way to limit the recruiter's access to the students, but it's also what I found a very good organizing tool. It's something that's very clear, very doable, very definite for you as students, parents, residents in the district, to start the discussion with someone in your school district. So you have the right to opt out of having this information released. But how does that actually happen in a lot of school districts? What we found in Watkins Glen, for example, kids were given numerous flyers to bring home at the beginning of the school year, and buried in the middle of one paragraph on one flyer was the information that, you can opt out by sending us a letter, and we will strike the contact information from the list. Well, that's a very, very weak way of doing this. As we all know, if you have to sit down and write a letter, drafting it from scratch, it's probably ain't going to happen. What we've done, and I think a lot of other districts have done, we went and actually talked to the principal and superintendent in the school and requested that a form letter be drafted that would be sent out to the students. And as I said, this was a great way to start the discussion about the military access to the schools, not getting into tabling or counter-recruitment. Just simply finding out if a form letter could be sent home to the students, and we took it one step further. We asked that it not be sent out in this big packet of information or just brought home by the kids. It actually went out in a separate mailing, which was actually suggested by the school district. They came up with that idea. And that way, when it comes to the home, people pay attention to it more. One misconception is that if you opt out of this, the student might not get any contacts from prospective employers or colleges. So that's why the form letter is very helpful, because that spells it all out.
When I talked to the principal at the Tioga Central School and said, why no letter came home, why nothing? He said, oh, we made public notice in the local paper. That's a penny saver. Public notice, like everybody reads
penny
those?
Saver.
Yes.
And if you look at the sample letter that specifically says that this is concerning release of information to the military recruiters, mm-hmm. You're not saying we don't want information sent out to colleges or prospective employers. I want to make it clear that it's not just the parents that can sign out these opt-out forms, but it's also the students. The students have the right. And then I just want to let you know that in Watkins, with about 80 kids in the graduating class,
80 to 90.
The year before we started this, they got 5 opt-out requests. Last year they got 50. So what that's really telling us is when people know what they can do, they really don't want this information released.
Donna, you want up next?
Okay, I'm going to talk about registering with the Selective Service. And if you walk into the post office, they have the little tables, and on the little tables where you can sit and address your envelopes, there are cards. Postcards, and that's how you sign up for the Selective Service. And all young men are legally required to do so within 30 days before to 30 days after their birthday. And it seems real cut and dried. You do it or you don't do it, but it's less so. Those names are what are listed for the draft, which we don't have right now, but should there be one, this is our pool of young men that they're going to pull for. Right now it is only young men. Should a law come into effect, it could probably involve young women also. If you don't register, you are liable for up to 5 years in prison and $250,000 fine. If you don't register, you give up all chances toward having any kind of federal financial aid for college, any kind of advanced education. You give up any chance of taking part of any kind of federally financed job training at all. You can never be employed by the federal government. Even so, some young men still weren't signing up. And so in New York, there's another law. If you get a permit or you get a driver's license, you are automatically signed up. So they pretty much managed to get everyone on the list. When you're sending that card, though, you do have some options. That's where you can either start to, if this is kind of where you're beginning to think about conscientious objection, or add to, if you've been building a file as a conscientious objector. When you get the card, pick up the little card, young men can write something on the card. I am morally opposed to war. I am a conscientious objector. I will, whatever speaks for that person, whatever it is that they believe, write it very simply on the card. And then if you just send it in, they take the information from the card at the Selective Service and they discard the card. So the next thing you do is put the card in the copier, which is in pretty much every post office I've been in, and then you fold your paper that you get out of the copier that has your copy in there where you have written your statement on the card, and you address it to yourself, and you send it. That way, it comes back to you in 2 days with a postmark right on this paper with the card that shows, oh, look, the draft just happened. Now, all of a sudden, I don't want to go. No, I have a long-held belief. Here, I'm leaving a trail of what I believe. Okay, then if you want to continue working with this idea, you're going to get a card back from the Selective Service saying, thank you for registering. Now, I know of young men who've gotten the card, thank you for registering, who haven't registered because the information was gained other ways. At that point, you can say, oh, I'm sorry, write on the card. There's been a mistake. I am a conscientious objector. You do the same thing. Send it through the copier, send a copy to yourself, send the card back to them. Again, they're going to discard it, but you have the copies. Some people even will have a return receipt requested if they really want to pursue it. And you can play that as long as you want. But to establish the trail is important. Another thing that is important is they want to know if you move. And it's a good thing to keep up because if a draft does start, you get your notification via the mail. You've got 10 days to report. Okay, if you filed in New York and now you're going to school in Seattle and your mom's got to forward it to you, you've lost time. So it's important, but it's also one more chance to say, I'm still a conscientious objector, but this is where I live now. And so you're establishing. And keep copies of it all. That's a really important thing. It goes into your file. So there's a couple other ways. We have heard anecdotal stories from a lot of young men who didn't want to sign up with Selective Service, and they got registered one way or another, and some of it was before the driver's license law was passed, and so it's like speculating, how did they get me? And it seemed like maybe voter lists, graduation lists, but there are other things that are happening. There are certain sites that you can go to on the web, and they have these really exciting, violent, military-type games, and you fill in your information when you go into the website, you're registered. You are now. So, one personal experience, my oldest son went to school a year early. He was 17 years old, so he got federal financial aid. The second year he was in school, his birthday passed, his 18th birthday, and he got a card in the mail saying, sign up now or you lose all your financial aid. And so he went the I am a conscientious objector.
Does anyone know if it's true, if you take the SAT, does the Educational Testing Service also will send that information on, isn't it?
The SAT, actually, they're in a lawsuit with ACLU right now because they only give you the option at the top of not having information given any place. They don't tell you that one of the places they give the information is to the Pentagon. Under No Child Left Behind Act, all schools are required to send academic records of all their enrolled students to the U.S. Department of Education. The problem is that they require names, social security number, all the other private information about the students to be sent to the U.S. Department, and the Department of Ed, Federal Department of Ed, has given free access to the military. So there are lots of ways that the military is going to get information about young people, although I'm very, very supportive of working with opt-out information. It's a wonderful organizing tool. You have to be careful that people don't think that that's the only way the military is going to get information, because there are many other ways as well.
From what you said at the beginning, that recruiters were allowed the same access as colleges and other employment recruiters, but what it seems to me is that there are actually recruiters that are pretty much hanging out at certain schools day after day after day, which I'm not under the impression that college representatives or other sorts of people are.
That's absolutely true. And until a citizens group goes in and talks about equal education and equal access and the terms of the No Child Left Behind Act, many schools are actually, principals are ex-military and very supportive and think this is the best way to deal with their disciplinary problems. And technically, however, a recruiter is not supposed to be on school grounds unless they have specifically requested to be on there and been given permission to be on there. And if they are on the school grounds, then other groups like us should be able to get on. One of the things we find sometimes, though, is that they're so used to the military recruiters coming in, even if they control it to once or twice a month, that if they let us come in, say, to talk to a class, then they think, oh, under equal education, we've got to let a recruiter talk to a class, even though they've had access and they're there all the time. It's really interesting the way the No Child Left Behind part of equal access came about. There were a lot of schools before the act was passed in the, 2001, that weren't allowing recruiters on campus. So when they went to draft this part, they wanted to make sure that no school could forbid recruiters from being on campus. And in a way, it has actually backfired because the language of it says, each local educational agency receiving assistance under this act shall provide military recruiters the same access to secondary school students as it provided generally to post-secondary educational institutions or to prospective employers of those students. So theoretically, if they have a job fair once a year or a college fair once a year, we can argue that that's the only time that recruiters should be allowed on campus. Mm-hmm. Let's look at recruitment fraud, and I'm sure you all know stories. Contrary to what the military would have you believe, the people who do recruitment, generally it's not a preferred job. It's not a job that means you're on a career ladder and you're doing real well in the military. They have very high quotas these days. There's a lot of pressure on them. So like any salesperson who has a lot of pressure, who doesn't make any money if they don't sell the product, recruiters have a great deal of pressure on them to sell the military to young people and to get them to enlist. And it's very true that young people who are doing well in school, who are possibly college-bound, who have good grades, are targeted. But the people who are most targeted are young people who are not doing very well in school, those who are unhappy with their lives, poor, and people of color. The African-American community has gotten together, and the percentage of recruits for this war right now from African-American high schools has gone down dramatically, which is very good. It's still very high for Puerto Rican children. The recruiters know it's a way out of the, and they love to prey on someone who's just broken up with their girlfriend, had a fight at home, or whatever. By and large, the bottom line is recruiters lie. If two young people go into talk to a recruiter in the school halls or in the recruitment station and say they want to go in together, they want to go in under a buddy system, the recruiter is very likely to say, oh, sure, I can make a note of that, and you two will go through training together, and you two will go wherever you're going together. That's not going to happen. Recruiters will find out that you're interested in something. We have the son of a very good friend of ours who was interested in going to interpreter school.
and was promised that he was going to go into interpreter school. But he's now in special services in Korea, actually, and about to be sent to Iraq. They'll tell you you're going to go wherever you say, whatever your interest is. And it doesn't mean it's going to happen. It's very likely not to happen. The military has no obligation to honor such a request. I just had a young man who's in the military that was asking me to help him because he wants to get out as a CO. He just came back from Iraq. And he gave me a copy of the contract he signed with the military when he went in. He went into the National Guards. The contract is 40 pages long, small printing, with checkoff places, one or two on every single page. And I asked him if he had read it. And now this is a very bright young man. He's a college student now. And he said, no, the recruiter said, you know, just check this. It's all okay. Just check here and just check here and just check. But you've read it. And he did. And if you're a young person who doesn't read much, who doesn't like printed material, you're not going to read those 40 pages and look at all that material and really think about it. So one of the things on those 10 points that we suggest that people do is make sure you get a copy of the contract, take it home, and go through it with an adult, a parent, another person. We also suggest that if you get a promise for something, get it in writing. If the recruiter makes a promise, get it in writing. Usually they won't put it in writing. But
we had a real-life experience in Watkins. One student said that the recruiter promised him, what, $5,000, $10,000 as a sign-up bonus, but this kid was smart enough. He said, my mom and my dad are coming with me whenever anything's signed. When it actually came time to get it in writing, the recruiter said, well, it's $3,000. The kid said, well, what about the $5,000? He said, well, that was wrong. So they will lie, I guess. Mm-hmm. And you do need it in writing or it doesn't stand up anywhere.
There's an indefinite commitment at the end of the contract that obligates you to more than 8 years of active service. If it's an indeterminable length of time, and most of these kids don't understand that. They're thinking short-term increments.
That's right. But if they don't understand it, if I signed it, not understanding it is not an excuse under the law. The amount of recruiter fraud has gone up dramatically. Several years ago, there were something like 52 cases that were prosecuted within the military, by the military. 2 years ago, it was up over 1,000 cases, and something like one-third of recruiters at any given time are under investigation for having made false promises or for having done something that violates the military code. And then the final thing I wanted to say, in today's climate with the Patriot Act, that if you get involved in this kind of work, it is very, very likely that you will have an FBI file developed on you if you do not already.
Yeah.
I suspect many of us in this room already have one. It is a possibility, and with the infiltrating Quaker peace groups in Florida and other places. And okay, Donna's on with DEP.
The Delayed Enlistment Program. A lot of times, recruiters will get 16 and 17-year-old young men and young women to enlist with the promise that they'll go into boot camp when they're 18. Mm. And so the kids sign a paper, which legally they're not allowed to sign a contract when they're 16, and they think that they are now in the military. And the very first time I went into Watkins Glen, we had a young man who hovered about 8 or 10 feet away from the table, like he sort of wanted to talk to us, but he didn't want to get close. And it turned out he was in the delayed entry program, and he said that they made him take, like, an oath and everything. He said this stuff, but he wasn't old enough to have legally done this or to be bound by it. And he was sort of gung-ho on it, but then as he talked to us, he started saying, well, it's not quite as cool as I thought it was going to be. So if you think back to what it was like when you were 16 or 17 years old and all the different ideas you have for what you want to do as you get older, how much there is to explore, what you want to go to school for, what you want to devote your life to, you can get really excited about something, and then you start to rethink it and come closer to what it is you want to do. But if a recruiter takes advantage of you at that, like, exuberant teenage moment, you might think that you're bound. And the recruiter will tell you that you are bound. And they'll tell you if you don't show up, you are now AWOL. They'll tell you if you don't show up, then you're going to lose all the federal privileges that you might have had, just like we were talking about, not signing up for the selective services. If you don't show up, you are going to end up with a dishonorable discharge. Well, it's not true, because you're not really in the military until you're 18, show up at boot camp, and then take the oath. So if a young person signs up for the delayed entry program and they decide they don't want to do it, they don't even have to say why they've decided they don't want to do it. And somebody put it very elegantly, signing up for the delayed entry program is like being engaged. If you don't want to get married, just don't show up at the altar. And if you don't show up at the altar, marriage doesn't happen. But recruiters are not going to let the kids know this. So I guess a more hard copy way of doing it is you write a letter. It would go to your recruiter, your commanding officer that you're supposed to, but it can also go to your senators.
No more contact. Then,
right, then you don't talk to the recruiter again. Because they're going to, they need to keep their numbers up, they need to meet their quota, and they're really counting on you being one of their numbers for that month. Don't talk to them. I mean, this is where we've heard some horror stories of, and it doesn't happen often, but it does happen.
I had a real-life incident where someone I know called me up, and a kid working for them had signed the papers for DEP, not knowing at all what he had signed, and then the military called up and said, you got to report within a week. He ended up going. Because the recruiter was telling him and his family, he'd be AWOL, would never get Social Security when he retires, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, some of the other horror stories we've heard are of kids being actually kidnapped by the recruiter and taken someplace into a motel and being kept there until they change their mind, or being kept there until it's time to deliver them to boot camp so that they can't back out. And those kind of stories have come more from the national organizations. And if that happens, they've got to call the GI Rights Hotline, which is listed in this brochure. But when you're desperate for someone, and this is working, and you can sort of coerce these kids and scare them into showing up, that's what's going to happen. So it's really important for everybody who's working with the kids to let them know, if you've signed up for delayed enlistment, you don't have to go.
The other thing, kids that are in the DEP program are asked, and this is part of the recruitment guidelines, to provide names of other people that they know, other friends, who are most likely to join the service. And this young man that we were talking to in Watkins had done exactly that.
Well, he had a position as, what, hometown recruitment assistant or something, and I was shocked. I had never heard of anything like that.
So what would your legal what would the child's legal standing be if they didn't write the letter and just didn't show up?
You don't have to show up. You don't have any legal obligation.
You don't have to write,
even
write the letter. No.
You don't have to write the letter. It's just, if you do, then the military knows. You didn't just forget to show up. You are not coming. Here's the letter. You're not speaking to them. You're not coming.
I'll just give the real-life story. I approached Watkins Glen principal. Started off with the principal, and he was very nice, and he was very helpful, and we didn't get anywhere. Well, you know, I found out some factual information, and there was no opt-out letter, and yes, the recruiters come in, et cetera. But I guess I was naive and thought he was going to call me back and schedule something. Well, it didn't work that way. First thing we tackled was the opt-out letter. Again, that was a really easy thing to look at. And then we broached the very delicate subject of actually having a counter-recruitment table. And that was kind of confusing, too, because we weren't quite sure who scheduled things. Turns out it was the guidance office. We weren't quite sure what was going to happen when we showed up. But they were very helpful. The recruiters were usually in front of the cafeteria, so we went. Well, the first time we weren't. We were in the lobby, which was fine, except that not all the students pass through the lobby, and they don't spend a whole lot of time there. So then they put us where the recruiters go, which is in front of the cafeteria. We went once. We decided to not schedule when the recruiters were there. That's a question that you're going to have to wrestle with. We decided to not go in when the recruiters were there. We didn't want any sort of, you know, us versus them set up. We actually, through a snafu, showed up when the Air Force recruiter was there, and he was there before us. We asked him if it was a problem for us to set up next to him or in the same area, and he was very nice and said, no, we want kids just like you do to have as much information. We don't want to get kids in who are going to be a problem to us, and we both set up tables, and we think that because we were both there, the kids stayed away from both of us. but anyway, if you're presenting it as a balance, there's no antagonism. The Air Force recruiter actually is the one who said, "Don't call yourselves counter recruiters. That's negative and antagonistic." Yeah. I think that you're more of a military recruitment awareness program, which sounded like good military talk. So we adopted that. And so Watkins, about every other 2 months, we're going in. They have usually the Marine recruiter comes in. We did have two returning vets, one from Afghanistan, one from Iraq, the two who achieved CO status. They did see active duty. They went to a class, and then they were followed the following week with an Army reservist who had just returned, who was not actively opposed to the war. And that provided the balance.
And in Ithaca, we have had, we brought in a young man who was a Marine recruiter for 10 years and then went to Iraq for a year, was so appalled by what he saw and what he was told to do in Iraq, and went through the chain of command and tried to make them aware that they were doing awful things, and was put in a mental institution and eventually released as having mental health problems. He spoke in three classes at the high school. The school, after we got permission for him to come to these three classes, decided the next week that they had to have a recruiter come to balance the education. Because Jimmy was actually able to talk about what it had been like to be in the war zone and to be actually serving in the military, whereas the recruiters had never served in the front line. The kids just really kind of panned the recruiters and didn't really feel like they were telling the truth.
Was it the school that decided that they needed balance and then asked the recruiter to come in, or did the recruiter say, "You had that guy, so we..."
No. Some of the parents found out. They heard that we had someone coming in to discourage children from enlisting, some of them, and they got upset. And so it was in response to some of the PTA parents who'd gotten upset. A very inflammatory, untrue email went out to parents the morning that Jimmy spoke at the school, and it got into a huge hoop-de-doo.
When we had the presentation of the vets, also we had a similar situation. I think we were a little naive. We had the two CO vets go in and speak. There was at least one parent that was concerned upon hearing that this was going to happen, but felt better after the discussion took place. One student in the class had an older brother who was a military recruiter and took offense at some of the comments that were made, and that prompted the follow-up by the National Guards. My feedback, what I'm hearing back, is that the two vets who had seen active duty, same situation, made a great impression. The other guy had been in the green zone, highly protected, and couldn't speak to some of the horrors.
One thing, we listened to Jimmy at the BCC down in Binghamton, and in the afternoon talk, it was loaded with Marine families who stood up and refuted everything that he said.
It was horrible. And at the last moment, my history professor, hearing that this guy was coming alone and what he stood for, got somebody from, I think he was the Air Force. Was he the Air Force? I think he might have been the Air Force. The audience was just filled with military families. And I know that this professor made phone calls, got the audience, got all these people into the audience. And it was really, it was horrible. It was a horrible experience.
Were you intimidated by the military supporters?
No, but I could see how somebody could be.
It was very emotional.
Yeah, very loud, calling Mr. Massey, basically calling him a liar.
On a slightly different note, some of my friends have decided to enlist, and I was wondering what you would think the best way of going about presenting the information to them now that they have already signed up for the program. Basically, how would you
Are
say
they in the delayed enlistment program?
I believe so. But how would you say the best way of approaching them would be to present the information and my side of this case to them?
Well, I guess I would think there are two ways. One way would be to talk about it from the 10 points perspective. And being a wise consumer, as someone says, you wouldn't buy a car without driving it or without looking at the engine. You need to look beneath and what the salesman's telling you.
Also, I think I would explore with them their motivation. For example, we were demonstrating on the corner, as we often do it once a weekend. This guy came across the street and engaged in a conversation. And he said he enlisted, and I said, why? He said, I need the money. And so you could, unfortunately, he was going on, but I wish I had some information then about, okay, what are the alternatives for getting money? Now, that's tough, especially if he doesn't have many skills or isn't doing well in school. But I think I would start with, where is he, and what has he considered?
That's right.
Instead of imposing too much on him.
Why is he doing this?
And what does he know? Does he know anyone that's been there?
I'd like to approach it from a sales perspective. They're trying to sell your friend something, and so talking to people who have been the consumers of what they sell, which are veterans that they can talk to, I think is the most effective. If you can get veterans that have been there and are disgruntled that will come and talk to your friends, I think that's going to be one of the keys to hear it from what their personal experiences were.
There are some young people, and I've had them come up and talk to me, who already look like they're in the military, who are just so gung-ho and are so proud to be signed up and can't wait to go and can't wait to shoot. It's going to be real hard. So, Alan, you're not going to reach everybody. One of the big things is take cookies.
Absolutely.
You may not think of that, but
cookies.
Take cookies or brownies or something. Yeah. That's the most important thing you have to do.
They've got video games. We've got brownies.
Marilyn Ray of the Ithaca Friends and CAM, Conscious Alternatives to Militarism, speaking at a recent counter-recruiting workshop in Montour Falls. CAM has no website, but you can contact them by phone at the CAM hotline at area code 607-387-8495 or through the website of the Ithaca Friends Meeting, IthacaMonthlyMeeting.org. And you can contact us and download this and previous shows at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.